Acts 3 is where we are. We want to finish that chapter today and then head into Acts chapter 4. If you've been with us, you know that we have the healing of the lame man in the first part of the chapter. That generates a lot of attention. And then midway through the chapter, Peter begins to launch into a sermon. He's with John. They both apparently did some teaching. We'll see that from Acts chapter 4. And beginning with about verse 17, Peter says, "And now, brethren, I know that in ignorance ye did it," that is, crucifying the Lord, "as did also your rulers." Excuse me. And he goes on to say, Jesus, this is something that was talked about in the Old Testament. He gives them the command to repent and to turn again. We noted how from Acts 2:38, that's parallel to being baptized. And then he talks about Jesus. He went back to heaven. He had to be there until all things had been restored. We discussed that last week. And then he gets back into Moses, as you look at verses 22 and 23, and said, Moses said that someone was coming who would be like me, and that, of course, is Jesus. That brings us up to Acts 3, verses 24 and 25, bearing those last couple of thoughts in mind as we read these verses. "Yea, and all the prophets from Samuel and them that have followed after, as many as have spoken, they also told of these days. Ye are the sons of the prophets and of the covenant which God made with your fathers, saying unto Abraham, and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed." Now bear in mind, back there in verse 22, Peter said, look, Moses, that man that you respect, the great Hebrew that you appreciate so much, he was one who spoke about the Lord. But Moses wasn't the only one who talked about Jesus, was he? From who? From Samuel and all the prophets. So when you think about Christ, and I've made this point in several lessons, we've been looking at this off and on as we go through the book of Exodus on Sunday nights. Jesus is the message of the Bible. Whether you start in Genesis, whether you're looking at the book of Revelation, the 64 books in between, the message of Christ is the central point in the Bible. Now, sometimes he's a little difficult to see in the Old Testament, but he's there. And when you start going back and you begin to think about some of the stories that children are told, and maybe we've known for a long time, maybe those are some of the places where we miss Jesus, but he's there. People can sometimes go too far with this, but you begin to think about some things. For example, Joseph leaves home. Who also left home? The Lord did, didn't he? Figuratively speaking, you know, comes down from heaven. And you see that reflected in Joseph. When you think about Joseph too, and Joseph has, just like Moses, a lot of parallel points between his life and Jesus. You think about Joseph, and what's he provide eventually for people? There's what need? All right, there's a famine. So you have that need for food. When Jesus comes into the world, is there a need? Yeah. People are spiritually, you know, starving. They need that spiritual food. And what's Jesus do? He shows up and says, I'm the bread of life. Well, there's that Old Testament background. And as you start looking at some other characters, Moses comes along. You remember that story about Moses killing the Egyptian? He thought his brethren would do what? Thought his brethren would
understand,
but they didn't, did they? Moses was understood. Well, you have that detail, and if you isolate that, you think, well, okay, that's an interesting detail. It's a little fact I'll file away. But take that forward many years. Remember Acts chapter 3? Just like Deuteronomy chapter 18, Moses said, somebody's going to come after me who's going to be a lot like me in many ways. Jesus comes. He deals with his brethren. Do they understand? They also misunderstand. And he has some issues just like Moses did. So there's that connection as well. When you start thinking about Saul, David, and Solomon, you have those fellas. They have a throne. They have a kingdom. They, of course, would point to Jesus as well. You think about David. And, you know, what happens in a good part of David's life? Is he treated really well, or is he kind of chased around the country? He's got some serious enemies. Jesus, a descendant of David, comes along. He's also entitled to the throne, but what happens to him? Chased around sometimes. You have a lot of opposition, especially from the Pharisees and so forth. So when you start looking at the Old Testament, not only in characters, but you also have a lot of other things. Images sometimes. You have, sometimes it's because of a place, location. Sometimes it's by color. Sometimes it's related to the clothing that people wore in the Old Testament. Let me give you just a couple of examples. One of the things I think that hasn't been taught very much, at least in the places where I've been, is if you go back and you start looking at those Old Testament priests, you'd, I think, be absolutely shocked And hopefully we'll do this at some point on Sunday nights when we get a little further into the book of Exodus. But I think you'd be absolutely stunned at the number of things that you find associated with the Old Testament priests that pointed forward to the New Testament. Remember, what's Peter tell us about Christians? If you're a Christian, you are you're a priest. Well, there is a basis for that, an Old Testament basis. But let's run a couple references here just to give you a quick example. Numbers chapter 8, verses 15 and 16. Who wants to head back there? We'll get four helpers lined up. All right, Bonnie, Numbers 8, 15 and 16. The parallel to that's going to come from Jesus' prayer in John 17. That'll be John 17, 9 and 10. Who wants to take that one? John 17, 9 and 10? Don? John 17, 9 and 10. And then we'll also look at Deuteronomy 18, verse 5. Deuteronomy 18, 5. Glenda, you want to take that one? Deuteronomy 18, 5. And we'll, in conjunction with that, look at John chapter 15, verse 19. John 15, verse 19. That'll be Lois. All right, let's go back with Numbers chapter 8, verses 15 and 16.
And after that shall the Levites go in to do the service of the tabernacle of the congregation, and thou shalt cleanse them, and offer them for an offering. For they are wholly given unto me from among the children of Israel, instead of such as open every womb, even instead of the firstborn of all the children of Israel, have I taken them unto me.
All right. Priests, Levites, God says, look, they've been cleansed and they belong to me. They are mine. Okay, you look at that verse in isolation, you may not think about it very much. But then you move forward many years, you come to Jesus' prayer in John chapter 17, verses 9 and 10.
I am praying for them. I am not praying for the world, but for those whom you have given me, for they are yours. All mine are yours.
Okay. You may not, as you look at John 17, initially think back to that Old Testament reference, Numbers chapter 8, verse 15, but when you start putting them together with a lot of others, God says in the Old Testament, they're mine. New Testament, the Father, the Son say, these are mine. They're not part of the world. They've come out of the world. They belong to me. You have that idea expressed in the Old Testament priesthood, which pointed forward to the new. And then one other quickie, Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 5. Okay, chosen you to minister. Lois, let's compare that with John 15, verse 19.
If you were of the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, that I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you.
Okay, again, you're chosen, you're mine, and when you start going back and looking at the priests as far as what God said about them, the clothing that they wore, the service that they did, and those kinds of things, you begin to find parallel after parallel after parallel to the New Testament. So when you, if you read through the books such as Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers, and you know, you can go into Deuteronomy, you can go into, you know, Joshua and Judges, the lives of some of Israel's famous kings and so forth, you begin to find Jesus on page after page after page, and that's what some of the preaching was in the first century. They were trying to help people connect that. I wonder a little bit, from Acts chapter 7, remember as Stephen goes through that long speech, a lot of Jewish history, and then finally he's killed. I wonder if he wasn't trying to connect some of the dots for people to say, look, you're familiar with all this history, and let me give you all this information, and here's the conclusion. But before he got to tie it all together, they were so upset, let's just kill him. But you do have some of that going on. And like I say, I don't think anybody in this life, as far as a human being, will ever be able to connect all the dots. But there is a lot in the Old Testament. And that's why I think the Old Testament preacher, the Old Testament preachers, the old preachers from a few generations ago used to say the Old Testament is the New Testament concealed and the New Testament is the Old Testament revealed, because they do go together, and you start putting the pieces together as we've done some on Sunday nights, and you really have to stand back and say, wow, God is an amazing God and the Bible is truly a fantastic book. Don?
Well, I think you answered it with Stephen, but the Old Testament was pointing to the Messiah.
Yes.
Not in the Christ sense, but a Messiah to save the Jewish nation. And your answer to it was Stephen's. He was putting the dots together that, hey, you were wrong back then.
Yeah.
Because this is what the Christ did, not to save the Jewish nation, but the whole world.
And I think you see when the Jews, you've got thousands of people becoming Christians. They had the history, But it was just, people today say, well, the light bulb finally clicked. You know, we had all the parts, but we didn't know how it went together. But, oh, yeah, now we can kind of see that this goes here and that goes there and everything now makes sense. And for these people, it was a lot like that. But until they could have somebody actually come and start positioning things where they could line everything up. But once it started, and there I think is why Paul and the others went into the synagogues. Because they could say, look, let's give you a little more information, show some miraculous signs, and all of a sudden, we're on board. We believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. So it really is fantastic, but we're looking at that, trying to kind of piece things together in reverse, really, from the Jewish perspective. They would have looked at it from the Old Testament and then tying it into the New. Anybody else? Okay. Let's go back, Acts chapter 3, verses 24 and 25, and make some other points. What was God's purpose for sending Jesus into the world? You don't follow him, verse 23, you're going to be destroyed from among the people. You're going to be cut off. Look at the end of verse 25. There was this covenant which God made with your father, saying unto Abraham, and in thy, not seeds, but in thy seed, singular. Remember from Galatians 3, Paul says, and thy seed, which is Christ. That's what he told the Galatians. All right, he says, in thy seed, in Christ, what's going to happen? God's plan is for who?
All the kindreds.
All the families or all the kindreds of the earth to be
blessed.
Well, when you think about all the families from a biblical perspective, who would that involve? All the families. That would be the
Jews
and also the Gentiles. And the Jews for many years thought that they were God's special people, and in many respects they were. But here, God said, all the people are going to be helped through Jesus Christ. Now, these Jews should have been anxious to have received that promise. Peter pointed out how they were the sons of the prophets, and they'd also been a part of that covenant which God had made with their fathers. But going back to where we were just a minute ago, remember in Acts chapter 7, towards the end of the chapter, Stephen said, what kind of necks do you have? As he's preaching these people, he said, you are stiff-necked, and in your heart you are, or in your ears you are uncircumcised. Basically, you're dull of hearing. You're not willing to hear the message. But they wanted to be blessed by God, just like a lot of people today, but that blessing was going to come from hearing and obeying the gospel of Christ. Back to Acts chapter 3, verse 19. You need to repent and you need to turn again. You need to follow God's plan so that you can have those seasons of refreshing. But they were not willing to do that. Now, we'll give you this other quick point. When you have the word covenant that we read a couple of times from these verses, there are two different words for covenant in the New Testament. For example, one word would describe equality between people. In other words, if I make an agreement with you, we say, okay, for $50, I'll have you mow my lawn for the month. All right? We're on equal terms there. You know, there's nothing that's really different from me or you compared to one's paying and one's doing the service. But are there not some times where covenants are made by people who are unequal? Agreements are made by people who are at different levels?
Yes, sometimes, especially in the employment.
Yeah.
All right.
There's that. What about in the home? Might there be an agreement between a parent and a child? Yeah. And those parties are not equal. The parent should be the one who's in charge of the home. The child is the one who is under the parent's authority. The word that's used here that describes the covenant, it describes an agreement between parties which are not equal. Now you think about that. God made a covenant where the parties are not equal. Well, that of course would make sense. God was one party, the Jewish people were the other party. And that's still true for us. The covenant that we have is made between two people who are not equal parties. There's man, and then there's God. What does that tell you? What can you infer from that fact? We are in a covenant where the parties are not equal.
We have to be in submission to
all right. We don't dictate the terms, do we? We can agree to sign on and say, I will follow that agreement. I'm going to adhere to that. But we have no right to try to somehow alter the agreement or say, you know, we're going to rewrite it. I'm not going to follow that. We don't have any negotiating power, if you will. So that is a really important point. Anybody else want to make a contribution before we look at Acts 3:26? Don?
Janitor can always say, well, I need 25-cent raise or something. And the law said, well, you're okay, it's all right. You can't do that with God. So it's hard to get a covenant that you can, as an example of what God has given us for the New Testament covenant.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you can come up with one, I can't think of one.
No, I can't. Now, with that agreement, God has stipulated that we're able to ask about some things. But as far as the conditions of the covenant where he says, look, I require this for, you know, whether you're dealing with worship or salvation, you know, these are the conditions. And yet a lot of times people say, well, you know, God's a loving, he's a nice, he's a merciful God and so forth. All those things are true. But you have to also bear in mind that he has given us that covenant with those stipulations or those conditions. And, you know, God doesn't lie. So when he's given those conditions, those are conditions that are going to stick. And that's why, remember in John 12:48, Jesus said, he that rejects what? He that rejects my word has one that's going to judge him. The word that I spake, the same is going to judge him when? In the last day. Why is that going to be true? It's going to be true because God, the superior, has given this agreement. So you can see that coming through in a lot of different passages, and that certainly is one. But yeah, it is a striking fact when that finally dawns on some people. Anybody else? Okay. Let's take a look at that 26th verse from Acts 3. It's the last verse in the chapter. Unto you first, notice that he's talking to Jews. Unto you first, God, having raised up a servant, sent him to bless you in turning away every one of you from your iniquities. That goes back to the point that we were making earlier. God had this great plan to save man. And that plan is expressed in different ways in the Old Testament. As we said, there are a lot of different ways or aspects that you see it expressed as. And here, Peter says, God, he raised up Jesus, raised up his servant. Now, if you weren't looking carefully at the text, what might you think when you see those words raised up? God raised up Jesus. First thought might be this is a reference to the resurrection. But if you go back and you start looking at the context, raised up isn't the resurrection. Raised up means what?
Is it the message he was bringing?
Yes, he brought him into the world to save mankind, to deliver the message of salvation, and ultimately to fulfill that message of salvation. He was raised up to bless all people, everyone. And that, of course, is true for the people who are willing to turn from their iniquities. And that turning from sin, we know what that requires. There has to be the belief in Christ. There has to be the repentance from sin, the confession. And finally, from Acts 2:38, the baptism into Christ for the forgiveness of sins. The word that's translated iniquities is interesting. We'll come back to that in just a second after Don's thought.
I've got a question about the Jewish religion today.
Okay. When I look at the Jewish faith, my understanding of it is that you have a wide range of beliefs. But if there's one thing in my understanding that would be true, they still think that they are a specially chosen people by God. Now, they have different ideas from what I can tell about the Messiah. Some of you know are still looking for a Messiah. Other people now have kind of turned back to a political idea that there's going to be, you know, not so much a spiritual deliverance. Other people think that there's going to be some spiritual deliverer that's going to show up in the future and do great things. But generally speaking, I think the Jews still have that belief that, yes, they are the specially chosen by God.
Everybody outside the Jewish religion is going to perish.
I don't know how many you would find who would have that idea, just because society has changed so much. Again, I'm venturing a guess here, and I would underscore guess, but with current culture and its thinking about God, I'm inclined to think that you would at least find some would have the idea we're going to be specially chosen, but he's also going to do a little something for you. You're just not going to have it quite as nice.
The reason I asked that, I have a neighbor that believes that they still are the chosen.
Yeah, yeah. And like I say,
he says he's a Christian.
That's interesting how they do that. You know, you do find some people who claim I'm a Jewish Christian and, whoa, you know.
He's not Jewish.
Oh, okay.
He's not Jewish. He just says that God will still protect the Jews. And that's why we should not spend any, anything to protect the Jews.
Right, and that plays into a lot of the political decisions that people make as far as the people who are in power. They still have that idea that Israel is God's special people. So even though they may not have any real religious interest when it comes to Israel, and you see that trotted out, you know, our friend Israel, we've got, you know, this is our only ally over there in the Middle East, or one of the few allies. So religious ignorance, and you have some denominational people who have sometimes been very influential. You know, for example, you have Billy Graham, I don't know exactly what his position would be on Israel, but I'm just saying you have some high-profile preachers who sometimes have access to people in the White House and so forth, and their views sometimes become the dominant religious view. So if you have some high-profile people like that who believe that Israel is needing to be protected, then, of course, that's kind of how policy seems to go.
When I was young, my parents were involved in a movement that was called Jews for Jesus.
Yes.
And I'm assuming that's still out there somewhere. I don't know if it is like it was 50, 60 years ago, but they claimed that, if they were born into a Jewish family,
right,
then they departed from it, and that's what they...
Yes, I get their mailing list stuff. I get some of their stuff about once a month. They have me on their mailing list. But they are an evangelistic organization. They would consider themselves a Jewish Christian, but I put that in quotes because they would not be holding to the tenets of Judaism. They would say exactly as you did, we came from it, and we're trying to reach out to people who still believe in Judaism to show them that Jesus is the Christ. So it would be an evangelistic organization that would fall under the Christian heading. But yes, they are very active. They've got a huge mailing list, and it's still going strong from what I can tell. Anybody else? Or did we exhaust our hands there? Okay. Back there in Acts 3:26, a couple of the things I think that I wanted to point out. We talked about the resurrection. Let's go back to this word iniquities or wickedness for just a second. You've got that word being used seven times in the New Testament. Generally, it's translated wickedness. Here, of course, would be an exception. It's rendered iniquities. One source gave this definition. He says it emphasizes the side of sin that delights in injury, doing evil to others. So when we think about turning people from sin, iniquities, yes, God's interested in people who sin in various ways. I came across what I thought was an interesting description of sin. Steve can probably see here. Oh, yeah, there it is back there. it said that in an interesting, in a basketball game, the average foul was like 20.1 fouls. But then there's a foul, and then, Steve, can you help me with the wording? There's a more serious kind of foul?
Technical?
Yes. And the parallel was made to sin. Now, don't walk away saying that I think that some sin is good. I don't. All sin is sin. All sin is bad. If we can classify sin, the smallest sin is sufficient, obviously, to send you to hell. But if you think about sin in terms of basketball, or some other sports, there's an offense, and then there is an offense. And it seems to me that when you look at sin, it sort of falls into that same category, and I think that may be reflected here by the word iniquity. There are some things, we'll see that maybe a little bit later. In the Old Testament, God said you can sin with what kind of hand, depending on the translation. Anybody remember? You can sin with a high hand. What was a high-handed sin? I'll give you a clue. You're not holding your hands up when you sin. High-handed sin. What was that? Glenda, you want to take a stab at it? A little bit louder. No. You're headed in the right road, but you have to do a 180. High-handed sin. Okay. Now you're headed in the right direction. High-handed sin. What kind of sin was that?
Murder.
Well... Think more in terms of attitude.
Oh.
What's a high-handed sin?
Arrogance.
Well, you're headed in the right direction. Somebody says, I really don't want to sin, but I did. For example, the person bangs his finger with a hammer and says a swear word. Do you think he really wanted to cuss?
No.
I mean, he's just put in a position where that really hurts, and that just happened to be the first thing out of his mouth, maybe because of his background. But here's the other person who's been hurt by somebody. And he goes home and thinks for a week, man, I am just so angry. When I see him, I'm going to tear into him. And they come up with all the right words, and they have it, and then they look for an opportunity, and they just go, and they pin him to the wall verbally. Would you say that one of those was a high-handed sin? The second one was. It is sinning with that, it's the deliberate. It is the premeditation. It is the, I can do this, I can get away with this, and this is what I'm going to do. God does not have much tolerance for high-handed sin. Look at it from this perspective. Remember Luke 18? The two fellows who go up into the temple to pray. The one was a... And the other one was a sinner. The fellow who feels like he's righteous, what does he do? He's got a high-handed attitude, doesn't he? Well, God, I'm not like these other people. Look at me. I don't blah, blah, blah. And the other fellow, was he guilty of sin? Yes, but what did he say? God, be thou merciful to me, a sinner. He didn't lie. He was a sinner. But what was his attitude? There was contrition. There was sadness. There was recognition of sin. And what did Jesus say? This man, not the self-righteous guy, this man went down to his house justified. Why? Because he didn't have that high-handed attitude. That's really important. And I think that may help explain some other things too. Remember in the Old Testament, there are six things that God hates. Yea, seven are an abomination to him. What's one of the things God hates?
Pride.
We're slow this morning. Pride. Those haughty eyes, remember? Why? Because you're back to that high-handed attitude. As again, maybe we'll take a look at that a little bit later. But let's, before we finish up with Acts 3:26, unto you, he says, unto you first. Doesn't that ring a bell with us? Unto you, Peter's talking to the Jews, he says, unto you first. God raised up a servant. What did Paul say over there in the book of Romans, chapter 1, verse 16? For I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God unto salvation. To who first?
Jews.
To the Jew first. Peter's preaching that same message at the end of Acts chapter 3. And even in Acts chapter 1, verse 8, as you have there Jesus talking about the spread of the gospel, he says, where's it going to start? You begin in Jerusalem, Judea, and then you head up to Samaria, and then eventually you're going where? All over. But who's it going to go to first? Acts 1, verse 8. It's going to go to the Jews. So that is a message which is consistent. Unfortunately, the Jews did not want to hear the gospel. Most of them rejected it. And then you, of course, have the Gentiles receiving it a little later. Anything that might enter our ask before we turn over to Acts 4? Okay. Let's see what we've got in Acts 4, verse 1. And, so even though we've got a chapter break, you see that it continues. And as they spake unto the people, the priests and the captain of the temple and the Sadducees came upon them. Now here is a point that you want to consider. As you look at accounts like this, you can start reading through Acts 3 and conclude that Peter was the only speaker. But as you look at Acts 4, verse 1, and as who spoke? And as they spoke. So even though there's no indication in Acts chapter 3 of John also speaking, it seems to me as you look at Acts chapter 4, verse 1, that John also had some things to say. Peter, we know his reputation, we know his character. He was someone who was at times a bit outspoken, but still, he was not the Pope, as some have alleged. He was someone who was maybe just a little more visible at times. All right, as we look at the Bible, sometimes find people working in teams. In the secular work world today, that's not oftentimes a bad thing to have a partner. And you have a Bible example of that when you look at Peter and John here, plus some other cases as well. You also have, as you look at the text, and as they speak, or the present tense is used, ongoing action in the original text, while they were having this conversation, you have the captain of the temple, you have the priests, and you have the Sadducees coming upon them. I mentioned earlier, and this is exactly right, when you look at Jesus, you have the Pharisees serving as his primary opponents. But now, as you start thinking about what happens here, you've got the Sadducees. They're the people who start taking over and creating some problems for the apostles. Now, if you were an apostle, especially Peter and John, how had things been going up to this point? Pretty well or not so swell?
Would you say that again?
Okay, if you had been an apostle, in this case, let's think of it in terms of Peter and John. Up to this point, your Christian life, how smoothly have things been going? Yeah, but generally it's favorable, right? Remember Acts 2, they had favor, you know, with all the people, churches meeting, churches growing, everything looks pretty good. So you might think back and think, well, you know, when we were with Jesus, we had a lot of problems with the Pharisees, some issues with the Sadducees. But now Jesus went back to heaven. A lot of people are becoming Christians. There are a lot of people who are believing just like we do. We've had the chance to worship several Lord's days. Everything seemed to be going pretty great. You might be thinking that those problems that you had in the past when the Lord was here, what's happened to them? Yeah, they disappeared. Things are in the past. Well, if they were under that belief or they were thinking in that way, that did not last for very long. They received a rude awakening. Then, too, think about what we just read from Acts chapter 3 and now the first verse in Acts chapter 4. They've healed a man. A lot of attention. They're in the temple. They've gone up to the temple to start teaching. And, excuse me, after all this is taking place, they've got some people who are listening to them, and they're just building up steam. And as things are really getting good in the minds of the preachers, what happens? What we just read from Acts 4, verse 1. They're arrested. If you had been Peter and John, what would you have been thinking at that point? I mean, the sermon is going great. You've got plenty of people, they're interested, and you're laying it all out, and everything seems fantastic, and maybe you're thinking, wow, we're going to have a lot of conversions. This is going to be a really great day. We can't wait to go back and tell the brethren how well today went.
Is there a reason that in the earlier going that the Pharisees were the forefront of opposing Jesus, not so much the Sadducees?
Yeah, the Pharisees had a lot of contact with the people. They were involved with a lot of the religious laws and so forth. The Sadducees, I'll mention this in a little more detail in a bit, but they were sort of the aristocrats. So unless, you know, you're starting to bother the people with the money and the power, you're probably going to kind of stay off their radar.
But they said, I mean, they were preaching the resurrection.
Yeah, well, let's just put that on the back burner for a couple minutes. So we will get to that, at least most of it, and if we need to deal with more, but we will. But think about what must have been going through the minds of these people. Everything is going so great, everything is so wonderful, and then you've got these three groups, or at least three descriptions of people who show up. What probably would have been going through your mind as a Christian had you been one of those preachers?
It says that they was an evening and they take them into custody.
They might have been thinking that. I think I would have been disappointed. Everything was going so great. And God, why did you have to shut it down now? I think I would have thought that.
What happened?
Yeah. You know, why stop this? I mean, your word was being preached. The truth was being taught. People were interested. Let's toss in a couple of things here I think that are really important. Let's go over to a passage in the life of Christ. Yeah. Can you make that connection for me?
Well, you know, the Holy Spirit came up on them.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, they had a completely different attitude.
Yes.
From that time on. So.
That certainly must have helped.
And they were able to perform miracles.
Yes.
So, yeah, I thought their feet were anchored more in firm ground as far as believing that what Christ had taught them.
Yeah.
Not the resurrection, but everything else, and after the resurrection.
Yeah. Here they do hit a roadblock, though. And let's tie a couple things into the roadblock. We'll look at it positively and negatively. Let's take a look at Mark 4, verses 13 to 15, before we come back here next. Mark 4, 13 through 15. We've often read this passage. We're likely familiar with it, but let's look at it now from the perspective of Acts 4. Mark 4, 13 to 15. When somebody finds it, let me know you've got it right, Betty. Okay, does Satan have an interest in grabbing the word out of the hearts of people? Jesus clearly said he does. Now, the devil is not specifically mentioned in Acts 3 and Acts chapter 4. But think about the activity that's taking place. The gospel's being preached, a miracle's been done, preachers are really involved, and everything is going great. And then the authorities show up. I can't help but wonder if maybe the devil was directly or indirectly involved in that. And that certainly would have been his will for him to have come along. And, excuse me, the apostles now, whatever was going through their mind, let's take a look back in Acts 4 and see what we've got in Acts chapter 4, verse 4. A few verses later. But how many of them? But many of them, I wonder how many that was, but many of them that heard the word, what happened? They believed. That's a way of saying they became Christians. And the number of men came to be about 5,000. So had I been an apostle, or had I been Peter and John, I think my mind probably initially would have gone to where I described it. And that was, oh, it's been a real bummer. You know, things were going so great, we got shut down. The devil was able to come in and interfere with things. All hope is lost. But as you look three verses later, what's the text tell us? A lot of people became Christians. Not all hope was lost. There are some practical lessons, I think, in there. First being that as we try to teach people today, what's the devil trying to do as well? You know, we talk sometimes about God's timing, and he is interested in good timing and often does work in amazing ways when it comes to timing. But the devil is also apparently interested in timing. And when that word is being sown, his timing is to try to take it out as quickly as he possibly can. Excuse me. So fascinating to see how all that worked out. Any thoughts on that point before we pick up a couple other items?
Can God have countered that by giving Peter and John and the other apostles the opportunity to talk to the rulers?
I think you see that in Acts chapter 4. And whether you're looking right there earlier in the chapter at verse 4, you go down a little bit, yes. And that shows us, I think, that spiritual tug of war that's taking place in the world. You've got God, his will is unfolding gradually. And you've also got the devil doing the very best that he can to upset that will. But there is that constant spiritual struggle. Sometimes people refer to it as good and evil. God and the devil would be maybe a more biblical description of it. But yes, it is that ongoing struggle. And it's been going on really since the beginning of time. That it? Okay, a couple of the points let's make here. We do have this word which is translated come upon, being used other times by Luke, and that describes the arrival of hostile forces. And that's exactly what we have in Acts chapter 4, verse 1. You also find several times in the book of Acts the preacher interrupted. We'll see it in Acts 7, Acts 10, Acts 17, and Acts chapter 22. Part of the opposition force that came for Peter and John were the priests. That word seems to describe the chief priests who presided at the temple. You also have the captain of the guard. Not everybody agrees that that was a Jew. I'm inclined to think that that was a Hebrew in charge of the Levites and sort of the chief of police for the temple. And the people who had that rank seem to have been ranked right up there next to the high priest. So when this guy shows up with the others, you have some people who have significant authority. Then we move down to the people that Don referred to just a little bit ago. You have a reference to the Sadducees. They're important in the New Testament. You have them mentioned 14 times, 7 times in Matthew, once in Mark, once in Luke, 5 times in this book. And they were sort of the rival sect of the Pharisees. So very important. They had a great deal of power, and they were the people who took pretty much the foremost part in persecuting Jesus. We've been talking about that on Wednesday nights. Now, Sadducees were somewhat typical as far as a lot of politicians in our day and time. There are some people, they claim if they're elected, what are they going to go to do? What are they going to go to Washington and do? You elect me and what's going to happen? I'm going to go and I'm going to change. We need to drain the swamp and we need to do this and we need to do that. Well, sometimes all that fire sort of gets lost after people get to Washington. But then you have some people, even though they may say that in their heart, what do they want to do? They want to get to Washington, and what's their plan? Well, what's the opposite? We really are quiet this morning. Yeah, we just want to keep the status quo. We're not going to shake anything up. And if you think about politicians who are in the let's keep the status quo, those were the Sadducees. Let's just have everything, you know, go well. We've got our money, we've got our influence, we've got our power. So as long as things come along and everything stays fine, We're not so concerned about that. The Pharisees, they were of a different mindset. So there was some rivalry. There was some tension between these two groups. The Pharisees were like the Pharisees in that they didn't like any kind of public disturbance. The Romans liked peace and quiet. They liked to have things stay orderly. And the Sadducees were also very much interested in that. I'll give you this quote. To preach that Jesus, talking about the Sadducees, whom they had hunted, was risen. And Don, this goes back to your point as well. To preach that he was risen, and all who believed in him should eventually rise like him, and do that by virtue of his power, was to lay the axe at the root of their favorite dogma or teaching, that this life was the whole of man's existence. Now you think about that. There is this group, And their teaching, their belief is that there is nothing beyond this life. This is all you get. Well, that would help account for why they wanted the money, the status, the power, and so forth. And what do we remember about the Sadducees when it came to the resurrection and angels? What did they believe in? Zilch. Well, if you've got this group of fiery preachers going out, and they're telling people, hey, this Jesus that you guys had a hand in killing, what's happened to him? He's returned from the dead. He's gone to heaven. What's that going to do to you? That's going to send you into a tizzy, isn't it? And then you start saying, if you become a follower of Christ like these thousands of other people, what's going to happen to you at the end of time? You're also going to be raised up, and you're going to be with him. And if you don't want to believe in him, what's going to happen to you? You're going to be raised up too, but what's going to happen to you? You're going to be sent to an eternal hell. You talk about upsetting some people. I mean, this was their core belief. This was their core doctrine. And for the apostles to go out and start preaching this kind of stuff, it really incensed them. They were very, very angry. So they come after the apostles really with all they have, and you see that in the first verse of Acts 4. Gary, did you have a thought? Okay, anybody else have a thought? Okay, not a good place to break a class, but let's at least read Acts 4:2 and see if we can make a few more points. Excuse me. Being sore troubled, notice that. Being sore troubled, that of course would be the people who were from the Sadducees, because they taught the people and proclaimed in Jesus the resurrection from the dead. Well, we've already outlined why these people were so unhappy. The word that is translated sore troubled could be expressed as angry and upset, or even very angry. So as you look at these people, they are really to the point where they are fuming. So it's no surprise, Lord willing, we'll look at verse 3 next week, that they were interested in incarcerating Peter and John. Now bear in mind, Peter and John, were they trying to incite a riot?
No.
No. Were they involved in any kind of criminal activity?
No.
Just going out and saying, look, think about Moses, think about Samuel, think about the Old Testament. All those passages that you guys know and are aware of, those relate to this fellow by the name of Jesus. Even going back to Abraham, Acts chapter 3, verse 13, but the people did not want to hear the truth, and when they proclaimed that Jesus had been raised from the dead, these folks were really, really upset. The teaching or proclaiming that you have described in this verse, depending on your translation, is expressed with the present tense. That, of course, was consistent with the Great Commission, and that commission just didn't jive very well. But as we'll see from the next chapter, remember Acts chapter 5, verse 29, we must obey who? We must obey God rather than man when there's a conflict in the laws. And the apostles did obey God, regardless of what the Sadducees and others wanted. All right, I'm going to shut it down there today, but we'll stop and see if you have some other quick comments. Ray?
You made a comment about new college Christians and old college Christians in the swamp. That's on the news this morning. I haven't heard that Trump is going to get rid of the swamp creatures, and I didn't understand that.
Yeah, go in there and get rid of the corruption and change things up, change the old guard and so forth. He might do some things. But there was a statement which I thought was really good. It was made within the last week that when you have new presidents come in, the people who have been there for years, they call those guys the summer help. And the thinking is, sure, you might come in for 4 years. Maybe you can eke eight out, but we were here before you came. We're likely going to be here before you. We're going to stay after you're gone. And, we're just going to put up with you whether we like you or not. So it is an environment where it's very, very difficult to, the machinery is just so complicated and so massive, complicated to get a lot of done, whoever's in office.